So I hope you had time to get your coffee. We have to start now. We are already late because of the late termination of the plenary session. So it is my pleasure to introduce this session, Basic Sciences Infrastructures for Ethical and Responsible Collaborative Development. My name is Michel Spiro. I am president of IUPAP, the International Year of Pure and International Union of Pure and Applied Physics, and I am also the promoter of the International Year of Basic Sciences for Development in 2022. This proposal was brought up by Jordan to the UNESCO Executive Board and General Conference, and supported by Nigeria, Russia, Vietnam, and Palestine. It was recommended by UNESCO Executive Board and by the General Conference these last days. So now it has to go to the UN. I hope that Jordan will help us to bring it to the UN, United Nations, next year, so that in 2022 we can celebrate, after the International Year of Physics, of Chemistry, of Mathematics, of Astronomy, of Crystallography, of Light, to celebrate the International Year of Basic Sciences for Development. This session is very relevant to this concept of Basic Sciences for Development, since we will see that organizations like CERN, light sources like Sesame in Jordan, and hopefully later in Africa, in Asia, and in Latin America, theoretical centers like ICTP, which are also spread around the world, and Science Institute for Technology, the one in Montenegro, hopefully there will be others in the world. These are actions which contribute to peace and development. So we are two moderators, so I will leave now the floor to Michele Zema to introduce the session.
Hello, good morning, and welcome everyone. Thank you, Michel, for the introduction. My name is Michele Zema, and I am Director of Education and Outreach at the International Union of Crystallography, which is one of the International Scientific Union's members of the International Science Council. And I was the coordinator of the International Year of Crystallography 2014, and now coordinating its legacy. First of all, I would like to introduce our panelists here. So please welcome Her Highness Princess Soumaya Bint El Hassan. Of course, she doesn't need any presentation for any of us. She's the president of the Royal Scientific Society of Jordan, chair of the Princess Soumaya University of Technology, UNESCO Special Envoy for Science for Peace, and I could mention a lot of other activities for advocating for science and science for peace. Of course, chairing the World Science Forum 2 years ago in Jordan, which was a fantastic experience. Next to Princess Soumaya, we have Professor Erwin Schoppe, former director of CERN and former director of the German synchrotron DESY, also one of the founding fathers of Sesame, the synchrotron for the Middle East, which is again in Jordan. And Professor Sekazi Mtingwa on the side of the panel, he is one of the most eminent physicists with a strong, who made a strong effort for contributing to the Afro-American scientist in the world. He is one of the co-founders of the National Society of Black Physicists back in 1977 and the former president. He's also, this is one of the topics that I think we will discuss today, one of the co-chairs for the steering committee for the African Light Source. And he is here in his capacity also as the executive committee of the Project LAMP. He will talk about this later on. We also have Atish Dabolkar, who has just been appointed as the new director of the Abdus Salam International Center for Theoretical Physics, so the ICTP. And Sanja Damjanović, she is the Minister of Science in the government of Montenegro. And she was the main facilitator for the Southeast European International Institute for Sustainable Technologies, which I think Professor Schopper was also involved in. And he's now the chairperson for the Intergovernmental Steering Committee. Let's welcome all the panelists here. In order to introduce the session, I just want to say a few words about what the International Union of Crystallography, which is the scientific union I'm working for, and the IUPAP, the International Union for Pure and Applied Physics, just like all the other international scientific unions are doing for the development of scientific infrastructures all over the world. And in line with the theme of our session that you can read over there, the unions are strongly involved and committed to implement initiatives aimed at allowing access to scientific knowledge and technology in all parts of the world. I just want to mention one of the initiatives that comes from the International Year of Crystallography, and this is to support the fact that we want to continue implementing international years dedicated to basic sciences, like the one that Professor Spihor has mentioned before. We had the implementation of a partnered initiative with the UNESCO, which is the Open Lab Initiative, which allowed us to implement as many as 30-plus research and teaching centers in over 25 countries all over the world, mainly in Africa, Southeast Asia, and Latin America, and many of these have become permanent institutions. So, of course, we have here representatives from many of the most important international scientific centers, like the ICTP, representative of CERN, and SESAMI, of course, and the LAMP project for Mexico and Africa, Synchrotron. And I have to say that this large-scale international scientific infrastructure are the most sophisticated example of open and multidisciplinary research infrastructure. And because of the high costs, because of the multidisciplinary use, these large-scale facilities provide strong opportunities for integration. And this is done through networking, through cost sharing, and they promote multidisciplinary collaboration with a wider global community, while promoting science diplomacy and peace at large. So this infrastructure, the basic sciences infrastructure that we want to talk about today, have become prime enablers of scientific and technological progress and innovation, and conducive to sustainable development in line with the UN 2030 agenda. So I think this gives a framework of what we want to discuss today, but I'm sure that everyone is waiting, is looking forward to Princess Sumaya's speech. So I would like to invite Her Highness to take the podium and give her a speech. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Professor Spiro. Thank you, Dr. Zima, distinguished panelists. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm honored to join you all for this thematic session on basic sciences, infrastructures for ethical and responsible collaborative development. And what a wonderful time it is to be discussing this topic as we celebrate the designation by the current UNESCO General Conference of 2022 as International Year of Basic Sciences for Development. Jordan, my country, was proud to champion this initiative with several partner nations and many individuals who made this dream a reality are now in this room today. Congratulations to all of you, but now the real work begins. And that real work will help us to win hearts and minds and hopefully to loosen purse strings. For there is little doubt that we are in lower and middle income countries, so that we in lower and middle income countries so often face challenges at home when expressing and promoting the concept of basic as opposed to applied science. There is all too often a feeling that basic science has no place in national planning because it absorbs precious resources and supports research that does not tackle immediate pressing problems. Indeed, many see wide support of basic science as a luxury that only wealthy developed nations may enjoy. This is a challenge, and such opinions threaten the stable development of many of the neediest nations on our planet. The fact is that any nation that does not support some sort of basic science infrastructure and the individuals and communities that emerge from it will remain indefinitely as a consumer of new knowledge rather than becoming a producer of knowledge and innovation. Such a situation can only serve to exacerbate knowledge gaps and to increase the costs of gaining and therefore applying knowledge for development or even for survival. It would better reflect our needs and our goals and perhaps make our task easier if we could only recast the labels from basic and applied to curiosity-driven and mission-oriented. But even then, we would have to emphasize and celebrate the value of curiosity when it is combined with the scientific method. For this is the formula that has allowed humankind to progress to where we are today. And it is the same formula that must make all our nations more durable and more innovative. Basic science must be the foundation on which societies and habitats survive, thrive, and grow sustainably. We must never shy away from extolling the essential virtues of basic science, even in the most challenged economies and communities. The process of investigating and answering the fundamental questions about our world is immensely important in every context and community, and the outcomes can have considerable beneficial social, environmental, or economic implications if tackled in the right way. Sometimes it is only by tangible example that the message can be sent and received successfully. That is, that out of basic science, applied solutions are nurtured and grown. Indeed, so many real applied products have been conceived or created on a bedrock of basic science. So many pharmaceuticals, including mass-produced penicillin, photovoltaics and solar cells, iron batteries, quantum dots and organic light-emitting diodes for TVs, gene editing, the internet, the laser printer, the personal computer mouse, hypertext, bitmap screens, graphical user interfaces, laser technology, semiconductor doping, radar, nuclear energy, and of course the list goes on. Ladies and gentlemen, there are times when language fails to convey real meaning and absolute importance. The fact is, there is nothing basic about basic science. It is the oxygen of lively curiosity and of innate innovation. Many of the great international institutions of basic science have long seen the importance of supporting basic research and education in science-lagging countries. And I hope we all agree that the benefits are obvious and shared. Developing countries, by building strength and capacity in science, may harness and produce the knowledge and skills that they need to address diverse challenges, notably with regard to energy, water, the environment, health, and poverty. And of course, these are challenges that are notoriously ignorant of border controls. So a national challenge ignored can quickly become regional or even global. For this reason, many basic science institutions in research-strong nations support projects to increase the overall quality of research and innovation taking place around the world so that they can jointly tackle challenges that may affect us all. However, we must ensure that the priority is always to ensure basic science in those countries that most need it, and to ensure that the cycle of support and investment produces talent and infrastructure that may remain in those nations as part of a growing science base. Otherwise, the support is futile and the benefits extremely short-lived. There is no doubt that research-strong nations exert a certain degree of soft power by establishing international collaborations with vital funding and mentorship as incentives. We must also acknowledge that research-strong countries remain research-strong because they create and replenish a diverse talent pool. The fact is that, just like those challenges we should be facing together, the best talent also knows no boundaries. Talent is an exploitable commodity, and the mechanisms that make this work are hidden in plain sight. I could mention the scholar exchange programs, PhD fellowships, and visiting scholarships. They are part of the reality of our uneven world. We must acknowledge that these imbalances and admit to the drain and grain and gain of talent that they facilitate. This situation is not going to change overnight and will never disappear completely. I simply ask that we are mindful of what our true mission should be: to discover, to empower, and support scientific talent in those countries that need it most, and to ensure that a good amount of this talent, once liberated through opportunity, remains at home to build the strongest possible science base. That is when true change will happen. Ladies and gentlemen, we will hear much about SESAME at this meeting and in the future, and rightly so. This is a basic science infrastructure project that makes Jordan proud and makes political and scientific sense. This is a third-generation synchrotron light source that provides a cooperative venue for researchers to engage in experimental science. Most importantly, it's a user facility that provides access to scientists, including graduate students from universities and research institutes, to carry out high-level experiments. And I think almost everybody on the panel was there at the opening of SESAME in Allan, so it's so good to see you all again here today. It is a surprise to many that people, not least in Jordan, do not realize that SESAME serves no applied purpose. It is a complex instrument created for the sole purpose of uncovering new knowledge while drawing together scientists from across our region. It is a true example of how basic science is anything but basic in its importance and its potential. And as we plan for the International Year of Basic Science for Development in 2022, let us ensure that we reframe the debate to place low- and middle-income countries at the forefront as hosts, beneficiaries, and most importantly, as long-term science-enriched economies. I would like to extend a renewed thank to our co-organizers of this session, the International Union of Pure and Applied Physics, International Union of Crystallography, the Abdus-Salam International Center for Theoretical Physics, the International Science Council, CERN, ICISE, and the Dhofar University. I look forward to hearing from my fellow speakers today and to supporting basic science initiatives now and in the exciting years to come. Thank you very much. I would also like to take a captive audience hostage, even if it means taking away 2 seconds. But one of my delegation has challenged me and challenged all of us, I think, to ethically find a solution to a question, which is, what is this symbol? We're seeing it all around the academy and Budapest. If anybody can tell us what it is, because I've been told that I'm not allowed to cheat. So I'm not cheating, I'm just asking for some research coalition and collaboration on this. We've seen it all over Budapest as the Jordanian delegation. Can anyone tell us what it is?
Well, lot of God.
So no one went surprised, right? Because I was the one that posed it, right?
Thank you. Thank you for this inspiring words, Princess Soumaya. Really, this was very, very fascinating. Let me introduce now the next speaker, Professor Erwig Schopper. Probably most of you know him, but I want to remind you that he was former Director General of CERN from 1981 to 1988. The Large Electron-Positron Collider, LEP, at CERN with a 27-kilometer circumference ring was proposed and constructed under his leadership. This ring is still used today with the Large Hadron Collider LHC. So you see, this is really a vision of an infrastructure which started in the 80s and is still active for another 20 years, presumably. It's a long-term vision. Schopper's vision of science without borders resulted in him becoming a founding father of SESAME, I think we can say that, the laboratory which was mentioned by Princess Soumaya, the laboratory for synchrotron light for experimental science and applications in the Middle East, which provides an extremely bright light source to investigate a broad range of domains from condensed matter to biology and archaeology. I think you will cover this topic, Erwig, so I don't want to insist too much. So it is in Jordan. There are 9 member states: Bahrain, Cyprus, Egypt, Iran, Israel, Jordan, Pakistan, the Palestinian Authority, and Turkey. So this is really science for peace. Finally, following the Sesame adventure, Erwig Schopper was a founding father also of the Southeast European International Institute for Sustainable Technologies, which recently, which is in Montenegro and in Serbia. No, I forgot. Okay, which will be covered by the Minister of Science of Montenegro, Sanja Damjanovic, and which recently took the decision to support the hadron cancer therapy and biomedical research with protons and heavy ions as the option for the institute. So, Erwig, this is now you have the floor. The slide, so I put the slide. Yes.
Thank you. Thank you, Michel, for these kind words. Well, Your Royal Highness, dear colleagues, ladies and gentlemen, it's a great pleasure to be back in Budapest here and be able to talk to you. I would like to talk to you about the collaboration between science and politics. And my main point is, of course, science is benefiting from politics, but my point is, I think it should also be the other way around. I think politics can profit a lot of science, and in which way? I think one way, which is one of the basic discussion of this morning here in the conference, is transfer of ethical values. I think one possibility is to transfer ethical values from science to politics. What values? Well, I mentioned here some of them. For instance, to recognize and respect other partners because of their scientific competence, independent of their race, religion, tradition, sex, and whatever it is, to recognize it. Another one is to learn how to distinguish real facts from fake facts. Or finally, an important point is to learn how to make compromises, forgetting individual interests, to make a compromise for the benefit of a common project. And there are many other points. Now, the main issue is that all this scientific collaboration with the collaboration between science and politics helps to create trust and mutual understanding. And without trust and mutual understanding, I think all projects in science and even politics about to fail. It takes sometimes time to benefit from that, but that we have to take. Now, instead of continuing to describe this collaboration and the benefits in abstract words, allow me to give you some practical examples which worked in the past and I hope will work in the future, how this transfer of ethical values from science to politics can work. The first example I have to discuss, of course, is CERN, the particle physics laboratory in Geneva. It was founded as the first European organization in 1954. And what is not so much known is it was based on two initiatives. There was one initiative by the physicists who realized that European resources had to be put together to be competitive. But there was another initiative by the politicians. There was in Lausanne, after the First World War, a first meeting of the politicians from England, France, and Italy with German politicians, where they were discussing what can we do to bring together the countries which were fighting during the war to work now peacefully. And they said, well, scientists are relatively reasonable people, why not use science? And these two initiatives were brought together under the conference in UNESCO General Conference in Florence, and out came the proposal to create CERN. Now, for a long time, CERN was the only organization which had in its convention this double task of promoting science and technology, but at the same time help to bring nations together. Now, there are many ways how to achieve that. Let me mention here only one practical tool. In the CERN Council, every country participating has one vote, independent of its sites. But in the Council of CERN, which is a governing board, every country has two delegates, a politician, government representatives, and a scientist. And that brings automatically, creates a platform where politicians and scientists in the daily business have to discuss and try to solve all the problems which come up. And this idea of having in the council a mixture of politicians and scientists is true for the following projects which will be discussed also. And I think that's already an excellent tool of bringing scientists and politicians together. Well, probably you know, CERN has been founded by 12 member states, as I said, as the first international organization in Europe. But CERN has increased now, has more than 24 member states, has a budget of about $1 billion per year. But most important, CERN, in a way, if I say it in a too simple way, is a service station which has a technology to provide facility which are used by outside users, by outside people coming from national universities and laboratories. Now, although CERN is still a European organization, the users shown here come practically from the whole world. There are only three regions where you're there's no interest. One is Greenland, apparently ice bears are not so much interested. And, well, the other one is, unfortunately, Sub-Saharan Africa is still missing. But apart from that, there are users of CERN, scientists coming to CERN, working at CERN from practically all the world. So although CERN is still formally a European laboratory, practically it is becoming a world laboratory. So I think that is another excellent way of scientific policy, bringing people together. And as I say, it's not only scientists, always politicians are involved also. So as a result, well, CERN, I think, is recognized as being a very successful laboratory scientifically. We all heard about or Higgs particle or whatever it is, and has had many technological achievements. But here I want to point out that also there are many political achievements, political contributions from CERN. And I could give you now a whole lecture about an hour what has been achieved by CERN during this 60 years of existence on the political front. Let me mention just a few. One of the first ones was during the hottest phase of the Cold War. CERN was the only Western, the first Western organization which was prepared to sign a contract with the Soviet Union at that time, which then became the basis for a similar contract between Soviet Union and the United States. Let me mention that during the negotiations between Reagan and Gorbachev for the nuclear disarmament, CERN, and I cannot go into details here, CERN provided a platform for neutral discussions, private discussions, which really helped to overcome the difficulties. CERN was a place where, for the first time, scientists from the China Republic, and scientists from Taiwan were allowed to work together in the first experiment, and that was not just an agreement between scientists, that needed the agreement of the top people in most countries. Let me also mention, without going into details, CERN during all these years could help in several cases to help solve problems which dissidents from different countries had. CERN, I think, has done an excellent job, not only in science, but also in policy. And as I mentioned, CERN is becoming more and more a world laboratory now than a European laboratory. Now, CERN sees a certain obligation to transfer this spirit to other regions which need scientific development and where there are still strong political questions. And two regions where this is true. One is the MENA region, and the other one is the Balkan. Now, for the MENA region, the CESAR project, which has been mentioned already sometimes, I will discuss in the rest of the few minutes I have. Whereas we agreed with Minister Sanja Damjanovic that she will cover the question of the Balkan project. She is, I think, more competent for that than me. So let me come to CESAR-B. As usual, CESAR-B started in a discussion among scientists during workshops, but in reality, I think the CERN cafeteria is essential for all these new ideas to come up and take shape. So it came up, CESAR-B came up in one of these discussions, and at the time, then I had retired as Director General of CERN, so some colleagues asked me, why don't you take care of that? And I said, well, CESAR-B has a chance to be realized in this politically different MENA region only under the umbrella of UNESCO as CERN was founded. So I wrote a letter to Frederick Major, who was at that time, I wrote a letter to Frederick Major, who at that time was Director General of UNESCO, suggesting to create a quote mark CERN in the MENA region. He wrote to all the governments in the MENA region around the Mediterranean. He called for a conference, was in 1990 in Paris, where it was decided to create such a project. And an interim scientific council was set up according to the standard of CERN. And I warn you, be careful to make suggestions. It means that you get some work, because I was asked to chair that council. Now, of course, to get an international organization created under UNESCO takes a long time. It has to be approved by the General Assembly of UNESCO. There are 200 countries, and be prepared by the Executive Committee. There are still 50 countries, so I won't bother you with that. But thanks to the then Director General of UNESCO, Matsura, this whole procedure, which usually takes 4 or 5 years, could be condensed to 2 years. So after 2 years, UNESCO decided to create this Sesame project. And I want to quote in the decision, it was said, this Sesame project is a quintessential UNESCO project combining capacity building with peace building through science. And it was further said, it's a model project for other regions. So I think that was a very important decision. Well, you're asking about the sites. The site decision was very difficult because there were some conditions for the site. One condition was the host state has to provide the country and has to pay for the building. That was easy. But the second condition was every scientist in the world must have access to this laboratory. And we had proposals from 12 proposals for sites from 7 countries or something like that. So it was a very difficult procedure. But the essential point was, at a certain moment, the then director director general of UNESCO was Iaccarino. With him, we traveled to the countries, and we also had got an audience with His Majesty Abdullah II in Jordan. So I presented to him these two conditions. To my surprise, but he had been, of course, prepared before that, he said yes. He agreed to that. I said, can I have that in writing? He said, yes. Half an hour later, a letter from him that Jordan would accept these two conditions. And that was the real decision for the site. And I must tell you, the success of Sesame was very much linked to the support of Jordan. And without that, it would not exist. As was mentioned already by Michel Spiro, you see here the countries. Of course, the main two countries at the beginning was Israel and Palestine, but then other countries joined. And as was mentioned, surprisingly, Pakistan, Iran are members, and also Turkey and Cyprus, which are two countries with big difficulties. And I do not know any other organizations where Israelis and Iranians sit around the same table, and not scientists in the council, government representatives, who discuss the daily problems peacefully, and the same is true for Turkey and Cyprus. And it works. Well, what came out is the building for Sesame, which was provided by Jordan. And I have no. Of course, right from the beginning, we said this is a project not for the existing scientists, but for the young generation. It's for the next generation. So we started immediately preparations to create a users community with training and all kinds of things. We got a lot of support also from the International Atomic Energy Commission in Vienna for that. And here you see the first meeting which we had in Amman for the creation of the users community, which was supported and financed by Japan. And I don't have a pointer, but here in the first row you see standing there a German, an Israeli, an Iranian, and Jordanian, all next together, very peacefully together. Well, I cannot go into details. This machine is an accelerator, but in reality, it's just a strong light source. In a magnetic ring, electrons are running around very fast and sending out very strong radiation from the infrared to the heart X-rays. And there are many beam lines which can be established. And these beam lines can be used for all kinds of science, from life science to material science to cultural heritage and so on. The official official ceremony, opening ceremony for the this facility was in May 2017, again in the presence of His Majesty and right to the Majesty Princess Suraya. And well, let me make two remarks. Well, the as I said, the council is, I copied the convention of CERN. Council has, like CERN, always a political delegate and a scientific delegate. But it was decided so far that the president of the council was always so far a director general, former director general of CERN, because they thought it's good to have a neutral person with some experience how to handle international projects. But the more interesting thing was there is also a vice president of the council, and the vice president was decided to come from member states. And so it was decided over the years now that once an Israeli was a vice president, and in other year an Iranian was a vice president. And in the vote for this president, vice president, was always unanimous. So I think it's the only organization where an Israeli voted in favor of an Iranian and vice versa, an Iranian for an Israeli, and so on. So I think it's marvelous how this works. Just a few points about the operation of Sesame. The inauguration was not only a formal act, it really, the machine started to work. The machine has reached all its design values, is working very well. Of these many beamlines which can be installed, which I mentioned, two are in full operation, three more under construction. And combined international teams working on these beamlines, and they produced already a number of publications which have appeared. So it works. And in summary, I must say, so far, thanks to the support of Jordan, Sesame is a big success. It seems to work scientifically, it works politically, and I'm glad to say, so far Sesame has no real political issues, contrary to this complicated composition of member states. This was recognized in the earlier this in March this year, this was recognized by AAAS in Washington and received a prize for science diplomacy for Sesame, and so this is recognized. I must say, however, there are problems. It would not be true if I would say everything is blue sky. And the main problem is money. And it's not only the lack of money. There are political and practical difficulties. For instance, Iran wants to pay its contribution, but cannot because of the sanctions from the West. So one of the main problems of the laboratories now, there's not enough money to fully use this machine with all beamlines. But we hope that can also be solved long run. Well, let me finish and say that in the time where there's still so many frictions between countries and by saying hatred and violence, it is very gratifying that at least there are some science examples where we can see that science can help to bring countries together. So I think it's a small light in dark times. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Professor Schoppe. I'm not going to open the session for questions at this stage. I would invite the remaining speakers to stay, to please stay in 10, 12 minutes maximum in the speech. So we would like to have some contributions from the audience at the end of the session. And it is my great pleasure now to invite Professor Sekazi Mtingwa to introduce something about the LAMP project and how this became a reality thanks to all the activities that you did in previously. So I think I can. Okay, thank you.
Okay, Yuri Gielt, this is my attempt to say good morning in Hungary. Thanks so much, Köszönöm, Michele, for the opportunity, and Professor Michel Spiro for the opportunity to speak with you about the LAMP project. This is a project that was funded initially for 3 years by the International Science Council, And the idea for this project is to spread the knowledge and the awareness of the impact of these advanced light sources and what they can have in the various regions. And the regions that we focus on are Africa, the Middle East, Southeast Asia, Mexico, and the Caribbean. So we have quite a wide breadth to the regions that we try to interact with. So the initial funding was 300,000 euros from the International Science Council for 3 years, and you note that the project ends in 2019, at least the initial funding. But we are moving on ahead and have started raising money, or we some time have been raising money to continue the project into the next year. So these advanced light sources, Professor Sharper has mentioned what they are. It's important to note from this map, this gives the location of the various light sources around the world, and they're on the order of 50, but you will notice that Africa does not have a red dot. And in some other regions, you notice that the Middle East has one dot in Jordan and one dot in South America, which is in Brazil. So we are trying to focus on regions that have not been utilizing this type of technology and trying to beef up the number of users and so forth. So this is a sort of an area view. As Professor Sharper said, that you have these electron beams that travel around in circle, and you wiggle the beam with magnetic fields. You have these devices that wiggle the beam, and as the electrons travel around, when you wiggle it, it shoots off X-ray bursts. And as it travels around, you can do this all around the ring. So all of these little sticks sticking off of the circle are beam lines where people are doing experiments. And you're doing experiments in many, many different fields. And the biologists are using them to decipher protein structures. Material scientists are using them. People in paleontology are using them. It's just amazing the impact of these devices in science nowadays. In fact, in cultural heritage studies, people are studying the constituency of paint and are learning that, for instance, it seems that some of the famous painters like Picasso may have mixed in house paint with their professional paint to kind of stretch the dollars. So a lot of these things have been speculated upon historically. People are now beginning to see them, understand them better. So the LAMP project, we try to send inexperienced light source users to the various light sources. I mentioned there are on the order of 50 around the world, and 16 of them are partners with the LAMP project, and I've listed them there so you can see where they are located. So the LAMP project has five major tasks that we have been pursuing. One is to develop a strategic plan for each region. Number two, to establish a colloquium program where we send seasoned light source users to these various regions to explain what they're all about and to stimulate interest not only among the scientists and engineers, but also among government officials. We also publish an informational brochure. I have maybe a couple of copies left, which we publish all to explain in layperson's terms what light sources are. And we've published it in English, French, and Spanish. And soon, and within the next couple of months, we will have it in Arabic. And after that, we will have it in Portuguese. Another task, which has really been extremely successful, is that we have been identifying faculty and graduate students and have been sending them as a team of two, faculty and student, to the light sources for 2 months of training, and we try to follow up the next year with 2 months in additional training. Let me move on quickly. And the way we operate the program, in each of the five regions, we have what we call a regional committee. And for instance, faculty and students who want to go for training at the various light sources will send their applications directly to the chairs of the various regions. And so that's four of them, and then the fifth one in Southeast Asia. The third task has to do with the colloquium program where we send researchers out to the regions. This is an example of Dr. Thierry Dalmeida, who went to Benin, and he had a chance to actually have several meetings with the president of Benin. And in this particular meeting, you can see he's meeting with the cabinet of the president. And they were so excited about the whole idea of light sources and crystallography, which is one of the tools that's used to study materials at light sources, they decided to invest in a crystallography training program. So Benin just, within a few months, established this program so that this past May, about 50 students from Benin and 50 students from all over Africa came to Benin for 2 weeks of training in May. And then there will be another session. In fact, the session is going on right now, November 18 through 30, another session of about 100 students. And in fact, Professor Michele Zema will go immediately after this conference to pursue teaching, to spread. He's one of the world's best crystallographers to spread his knowledge. So the LAMP Project has been moving very fast on all of these initiatives. This is a cover of the brochure. Please go to the LAMP website and download this brochure because it really does an excellent job of explaining what light sources are all about. The LAMP Project has the faculty student teams that I mentioned. Okay, we have a 3-year grant. The first year we were getting started, we had 7 FAST teams that went to the light sources. That's 14 individuals. Year number 2, we had 32 individuals. That was 16 FAST teams. And this year, we awarded 15 FAST teams to go. And next year, we will continue with this program. So this, I'll skip that, gives you sort of a breakdown of where the various FAST teams come from. This year, we had 3 new teams from Africa, 1 continuing team, Caribbean 2 teams, and so forth. We try to spread the knowledge. As I said, the colloquium program, I attended the Caribbean Academy of Science big conference that they had in Jamaica, and from that we were able to engage with more faculty and students. This is a person who came from Botswana University of Science and Technology who visited Thailand's light source. And this is very interesting because Professor Kirsty Lorentz from the Cyprus Institute trained at France's ESRF, that's the European Synchrotron Radiation Facility, and her team was the first team to perform an experiment at the Sesame light source in Jordan. So we're very proud that one of our alumni of the FAST team program actually was the first team to do an experiment at Sesame. Let me go through this. I think what happened here is that made my presentation shorter and sent it, but unfortunately the one I loaded on my fast drive is not the one that I wanted. But let me just think I've covered most of the interesting things. I'll just end with this, that Herman Winnick and I have done quite a bit of work lately trying to spread the word about advanced light sources throughout Africa, the Caribbean, and elsewhere. And we had an editorial in Science magazine where we tried to point out again, to emphasize what Professor Sharper said, that these light sources are playing a tremendous role, not only in spreading science, but in spreading peace and cooperation, collaboration around the world. So we said that these endeavors will face challenges, which we just heard. There are challenges in terms of getting money to operate Sesame. But they share with Sesame the goals of building regional capacity and promoting understanding, friendship, and peace by bringing together scientists from different countries and ethnicities to perform world-class research. And with that, I say, Kirsinam Saipan.
Thank you very much also for saving some time. Yep. But I think there is a point. We have seen already some models like Sesame, CERN, and what you have mentioned about the implementation of light sources in the developing regions, places where we don't have enough infrastructure for scientists from this region. But I think you skipped the part about the African light source,
okay,
which might be a model again, or something that we can build thanks to the models that we have learned about. Yeah. So perhaps if you can say just one word about where we are with the African light source.
Sure. Okay, so the African Light Source is an attempt for African countries to pool their resources to construct one of these devices. You remember the map had no red dot. There is not one in Africa. And I remember it's been about 20 years, way back. I was a physicist at our Argonne National Laboratory. At that time, they were constructing the Advanced Photon Source, which is one of the world's premier facilities. And at that time, I was saying that this is something that Africa could have. So I've been actually trying to spread the whole idea of a pan-African African light source now for 20 years. But in 2014, Herman Winnick and I wrote a paper, and not the one that I showed you earlier, which was a call to action. And then the next year, Professor Simon Connell from the University of Johannesburg pulled together a committee, and we've been pushing the idea now of an African light source. We have a steering committee established. We had a meeting. We've had two conferences. The second one was just this past January in Ghana, at the University of Ghana, Legon, outside of Accra. The president of Ghana has decided to be the leader to champion this among other African heads of state. And that's basically where we are now in terms of trying to get the Africans to buy into the idea of building one of these. Unfortunately, these things cost about $500 million US dollars, so they're not cheap. But the return is tremendous. Thank you.
I think it's important to understand how the scientific community is moving forward for giving access to technology, to knowledge, to all scientists from every part of the world. So in the end, I think all these models will serve us for building more and more, to build capacity in the world. So, and we have another model that we want to hear about now. And Atish Dabholkar, I think you took on a very difficult and important task, being the new director of the Abdus Salam International Center for Theoretical Physics, which is also allowing many students and researchers from all the developing countries to access science. Can you tell us about this?
Okay, Your Royal Highness and distinguished panelists and friends, it's a great honor for me to be here in this prestigious forum. And I would like to tell you about ICTP, which has been a model of world-class research education and also a successful model for international collaboration, especially focused on developing world. And this mission of ICTP is particularly close to my heart since I come from India. And I was reading what was the thinking of Salam since, you know, to take his legacy forward. And one of the quotes that I came across was that, one of his books was that, in the conditions of modern life, the rule is absolute. The society which does not value trained intelligence is doomed. Today we maintain ourselves, tomorrow science will have moved over. Yet one more step. And there will be no appeal from the judgment that will be pronounced on the uneducated. So this is there are very grim words, but I think it's really true because, and which is why fundamental basic science is very important. And I was very happy to see the passionate plea from Princess Sumaya, and also to hear that from Professor Michel Spiro that UNESCO has approved this year, because I think it's very important to appreciate and explain the essential unity of science to policymakers and to the public. I mean, for example, one cannot have quantum technologies without quantum mechanics, and you need people in the country who understand quantum mechanics, or artificial intelligence without a good base of people doing physics and mathematics. And this sort of brings to mind this famous quote of Euclid, when Ptolemy asked him that, okay, can you explain to me geometry? It's too difficult for me. And he said, well, Your Highness, there is no royal shortcut to geometry. You just have to sit down. And similarly, there is no royal shortcut to advanced technology. You have to build the base. We cannot jump. And even more important, I think, today is creating a culture of science, which is all the more important in the post-truth era. And that requires a long-term commitment. And ignoring basic science is therefore very short-sighted, and it would be disastrous in the long run. And I was looking at Salam around the 80s. He was actually quite pessimistic. He felt that if he had tried to create a center like ICTP in modern times, he felt that the governments were becoming too short-sighted, and he may not have succeeded. So I'm very happy that UNESCO has acknowledged this. So what is ICTP? I will just tell you, some of you might have seen this before who know ICTP. So ICTP has a unique global mission to promote international cooperation through excellence in science at the frontiers of fundamental sciences. And it has a really enviable track record of accomplishments over the past 5 decades in pure science, in capacity building, in science diplomacy. And as Salam said, the science is a common heritage of all humankind. He was the founding director who got the Nobel Prize in 1979. And ICTP sort of acts as a place to bring the world together into the great stream of science, breaking barriers of geography, race, economics, and gender, and through a long-term commitment to basic sciences. And that is what I think we need to, at least in this panel and also in the year 1922, we should use this. It requires persuasion to the public and to the policymakers. So just to tell you very briefly about ICTP, ICTP is governed by a tripartite agreement between the International Atomic Energy Agency, UNESCO, and the Italian government, and it's a Category 1 institute of the UNESCO. By now, even though we started with high energy physics, which is also my field of specialty, we have now grown in many other fields like condensed matter physics, mathematics, applied physics, Earth system, which is focused on climate science, quantitative life sciences, which has deals with issues of, let's say, artificial intelligence and theoretical biology. And the idea of ICTP is not to be just a service provider. Excellence is one of our important parameters. And as you can see, we have been successful in maintaining excellence. Several Nobel Prizes were associated with ICTP. But now let me come to our activities in international cooperation. As you can see, we have a track record of building the foundations for sustainable science. We have something like 60 conferences every year in very advanced topics. Really the best people in the world come together from all over the world to lecture there, and students come from east, west, north, south together. ICTP funds most people coming from the developing world. Something like 5,000 scientists come from 145 nations, and about 25% are women. I hope this number will go up in the coming years. We have 8 postgraduate degree programs, laboratory training programs, career development, and a very, very important postgraduate diploma program. As you can see on this, it's a really like a rainbow mix of students. I have myself taught an advanced course in quantum field theory. And it's very interesting to see students from Ethiopia, Palestine, Colombia, basically from every student is from a different country, and that's very interesting, and some countries which do not have a long tradition. And about 75% of them succeed in attaining a PhD. We also have a very good scientific outreach program, actually. We have an Office of External Activities. So associates, this was Salam's original idea, that scientists who feel isolated because of their surroundings or perhaps because of the local circumstances, they can come to ICTP and get refreshed, get recharged. And we have several hundreds of associates spread all over the world. If you go to any small university in the world, you will see somebody. ICTP has had an impact. Something like 150,000 scientists have visited ICTP over the years. And these are all scientists. I'm not talking about students. These are advanced. So Salam's idea was to focus on advanced scientific training. We have now, to spread this mission in a more effective way, we have initiated these partner institutes. so that we can do locally instead of bringing everybody to Italy. We have a partner institute in Brazil, one in China, in Rwanda, and one in Mexico is kind of in the future. Then we have this very nice program of Physics Without Frontiers. Actually, Kate Shaw, who started that program, is here. And basically, they have been to least developed countries, her team, like Afghanistan. She had to go with the UNESCO protection, going to places where in Palestine. And you can see lots of very young, excited students attend these one-week-long kind of programs on particle physics. Some of them come to ICTP to do their diploma. In fact, this year in our diploma in particle physics, in high-energy physics, we have two women physicists. One is from Jordan and one is from Lebanon. And we have had students from Palestine who have gone on to do PhD at CERN, for example, or at ICTP. So it's a very kind of, ICTP has this holistic point of view that we really take the scientist from the beginning and throughout their career, ICTP. I myself have visited ICTP when I was a student from India. I then came to give lectures here, then I joined the institute. So it really has a kind of a long-term association with the institute. This is just a kind of a global map of our outreach. We have affiliated centers, networks, partner institutes, so I can go ahead. We also have a very outstanding set of climate physicists. For example, they were on the intergovernmental panel on the climate change. We got the Nobel Prize. The vice chair was from our institute. And we hold, so it has an impact on decision makers as well. One of the recent activities which has been very successful is the medical physics, Atoms for Peace. It's a little bit like the synchrotron or the one that you have in your planet in South Eastern Europe, because you need medical physicists if you want to use lasers and or X-rays. And some countries, actually, the only medical physicist in the country, I think it's El Salvador, is received their master's at ICTP in this program, and it's been funded by IAEA and it's a very successful program. So let me now come to sort of some broad remarks, if I have a few minutes. So this is about ICTP, but then one could ask the question, what made ICTP succeed so well? And in fact, I was reading Robert Oppenheimer, who was the first chairman of our council, and one of the radio interviews said that ICTP's growth has been unexpectedly rapid. And the reason is, I think, that science is a unique human enterprise that is naturally global and democratic, and it has high community standards of integrity. And it's a kind of a shared language that transcends national boundaries. I mean, a stone dropped in London falls the same way as it is dropped in Bombay. So, and there is a fundamental human need to understand how the universe works. And most importantly, nature is an external arbiter that overrides ideology. So you cannot say that the president of my country believes in something and therefore this cannot be done. Because science is what it is. So that's the one of the reasons, and ICTP Cafe is a kind of an example. I mean, it's a bit like this CERN Cafe, where people come together from all over the world, from India and Pakistan and Iran, and talking about blue sky research. But this is a kind of a forum for doing soft diplomacy. And one of the contributions of ICTP is the Trieste Science System, because of which we will have this Euroscience Forum next year in Trieste. And the slogan is freedom for science and science for freedom. And that, I think, very well captures the mission of ICTP. So I will leave you with this nice quote of one of our laureates, Rabindranath Tagore, about freedom for science and science, where knowledge is free and where the world has not been broken up into fragments. I think that's what ICTP strives to do. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Atish Dabhulkar, for this presentation of ICTP. It's a great achievement, which I hope will be spread over the world. I have now the pleasure to introduce the Minister of Science of the Government of Montenegro, Sanja Damjanovic. Born in Montenegro, she worked in two large international organizations, at CERN in Geneva and at GSI FAIR in Darmstadt, covering both basic and applied research in the field of high-energy nuclear physics. Sanja Damjanovic has about 100 publications in refereed journals and conference proceedings. Beyond science, Damjanovic played a key role in initiating an international cooperation agreement between Montenegro and CERN in 2007. In November 2016, she was appointed as Minister of Science in the government of Montenegro, following an initiative by Professor Hervik Schopper again. Made around the same time, she politically pushed the creation of the Southeast European International Institute for Sustainable Technologies, she will report on that, from early 2017 onwards to reach its present status of an official joint project of 8 states of the region, the Balkans. So I think I will leave you the floor now to present this initiative. Thank you to be with us. So just let me... S-E-I-S-E. Yes.
So thank you very much, in particular pointing that I'm not only Minister of Science, but scientist by profession. So ladies and gentlemen, it's my great pleasure to present proposal to establish a large-scale competitive research infrastructure in the region of Southeast Europe. We call this project SEAST. Acronym is not so beautiful, but it's thanks to Professor Schopper and no time to change it. So I'm addressing you today not only as a Minister of Science of Montenegro, but as a chairperson of this project. So the initiative came from Professor Schopper at the end of 2016, at the occasion of the meeting of World Academy of Art and Science in Dubrovnik, and our academic communities was not really embracing this initiative. At that time, I became Minister of Science of Montenegro, and when I learned about this initiative from Professor Schopper, I got really infected, and since then, we started to work together. The beginning was very hard, and we thought how to really now move something from the field, but in reality, it was not hard, because very quickly, we get a positive reception by many organizations and institutions, and so they are listed here. So, this CIS project is a regional center of excellence which will provide the first-class research. All of us know that real international cooperation, bringing people together, is really the best way to accelerate knowledge and innovation. It's the best way to enable better life, standard of life and wealth of our citizens. So all that is fulfilled by our CIS project. It will promote the collaboration between science, technology, and industry based on the transfer of technology from other centers like CERN and the others, and will also provide platform for improved education of our young scientists. But CIS project will bring even more. Another important objective of this project is to foster cooperation between the countries in the region where still some quite friction. So, due to recent history in the region of Southeast Europe, all scientific economic activities very much slowed down. As a consequence, our region suffers ever since from strong brain drain, which is our largest economic loss. However, we should not forget that in the past, this region had incredible period of technological development. For example, in this region, there were 3 international institutes, all older than CERN. Vinča in Serbia, which was established in 1948, last year, celebrated 70th anniversary. Jozef Stefan in Ljubljana, which this year celebrates 70th anniversary, established 1949. 1950, Ruđer Bošković. Not only that, in our region, the first research nuclear reactor started to operate only 2 years later than the first research nuclear reactor started to operate in Germany. Yugoslavia was a founder of CERN in 1954. For example, at that time, Austria was not a member of CERN. Now, the question is how to really return back the good technology tradition which we had in past, how to slow down and even revert the brain drain. The most effective way is to establish large-scale facility based on the latest technology. I think it's not only the most effective way, I think it's only only way. So what is our CEES project? It is facility for tumor therapy and biomedical research with protons and heavy ions, which today present the most modern and most powerful method of treatment of cancer. So in this picture here, you see such first machine in Europe, HIT Heidelberg, which started to operate only in 2009, 10 years ago. So you don't see the scale in this picture, but you can judge by looking at the size of the patients in this patient room. So only in the world today, there are only 12 machines of such type, only 4 in Europe, 2 in Germany, 1 in Italy, and 1 in Austria. However, our CEES project is not going to be just 5th in Europe. Our CEES project is going to be unique in the world. Why? Because 50% of the beam time will be dedicated to this research, and we know what cancer means today, and the cancer research is actually not by chance one of the mission of the next Horizon Europe program. No matter that 50% of the beam time will be dedicated to research, we will still be able to treat about 500 patients, which is the need for a population about 20 million inhabitants. And so this facility will offer capacity for about 1,000 researchers, including will be attractive also for users from Western Europe. So let me please explain why this method is the most powerful method of treatment of cancer. So I ask you for your attention to the figure on your left. So you see here dose, which is the liver along the depth in the tissue, and the red arrow points the tumor region. So with conventional X-ray radiation, you see that the largest is a continuum line, green and yellow. So you see that the largest dose is the liver on the healthy cells, and you see how little is the liver when you come to the cancer region. But different particles interact different with matter, and look what happened here with proton and ions beams. So you don't deliver any dose onto healthy cells, and all of a sudden you stop full beam exactly on the tumor region. And you do precise mapping in 3D by controlling the beam with two magnets in horizontal, in vertical plane, and by changing the energy extracting from synchrotron, you change the position of this peak. So this is very important for the tumors which are close to the risk organs. This is actually the only method to radiate pregnant women, and also the method which is used for radiating children. But why ions and not only protons? Because with ions, because of larger charge, they are kind of radio-resistant tumors, and you can't treat them with protons. You need carbon ions, and that's why, not only carbon ions, but heavier ions, and that's why they are really superior. Now I would like to ask you your attention on the picture on your right. So you see here the map of the particle therapy in Europe. All these points here, you see many more points than 4, which I mentioned, because they are mostly proton machines. But what you see here, actually now, you can take any other research infrastructure based on the newest technology, including synchrotron-like source and so on. You will see, all of a sudden, a large density of the points all across the Europe. But our region of Southeast Europe, which is the large integral part of Europe with 40 million inhabitants, remains a gray zone. So I lost the circle here, but you can see this gray area. So over just short time, we achieve a lot of success, both on political and scientific scene. On political scene, it took me only 3 months to convince the government of Montenegro to officially support this initiative. And only by the end of 2017, we managed to attract practically all countries from our region. So we signed a declaration of intent on the CERN ground, and there was a unique event at CERN. At CERN, you have practically every day politicians are coming, but was unique because at the same moment you had 10 ministers responsible for research on the CERN ground. So this signature was very important because it transformed our CST initiative into the regional project. So in this picture here, 8 countries signed declaration of intent at that event. They are labeled here in green. So nicely here you see our region, which I mentioned, Southeast Europe with 40 million inhabitants from Slovenia all down to Greece. And Croatia agreed at the referendum why Greece took an observer status. So very quickly, we got practically instantly, starting 2017, we got also support from European Commission, from the Directorate for Research Innovation, DGRTD, actually from Commissioner Moedas himself, and recently we got even first financial support of 1 million euro to start the second phase, so-called design phase. Money would not be enough if we would not get really warm help and open hands from the renowned centers like CERN and GSI. And with help of CERN, there will be a lot of new features in our medical accelerator. It will be more attractive technology than presently existing in the world. For the clinical, preclinical research issue, we got help from GSI in Darmstadt, and most of you probably don't know that the first 440 patients were treated with carbon, not in hospital, not in clinic, but at GSI in the research institute. And of course, we got also warm help, warm hands from Atomic Energy Agency, which will provide us support for capacity building. They just approved the first financial support of 500,000, and we know that agency, Atomic Energy Agency, was very crucial for the SESAME project for building capacities. So since this is not a project of only research, but also of health, also of diplomacy, it was very important also to get highest political support for this project, and we are very happy that this year memorandum of cooperation has been signed by six prime ministers of the region, education of the sixth summit of the Berlin Process, which took place in Poland this year. We also, over a short time, achieved a lot of success on scientific scene. So the first phase has already been done. We have a concept study. We have a document of 100 pages. And actually, this concept study was work with the largest experts in this field. And they provided that this work was on a voluntarian base for us. And we organized a nice event forum in Trieste at ICTP. And we really very much thank to this warm, open hands of all international centers. And that was event where a lot of people participated from politics and from research centers, but we had also 40 users from our region. And at that forum, for the first time, the concept study was shown in public, and this concept study is 100 pages document, which now appears also as a CERN yellow report. Now there are many actions going on. We got 1 million to start design phase, second phase, which is design phase of this project. We now applied actually for very competitive Horizon 2020 call, and we are convinced that we will be successful because we got support even from 18 European super good centers, including these 4 Hadron Cancer Therapy Centers, and of course CERN and GSI. We became association of Swiss law. We have now a legal entity that we also could apply for this project. So. Location is not yet decided, but no matter where this institute will be located, there will be national benefit across the whole region. Why? First of all, each country will have its own quota to treat patients, which so far we cannot treat our patients with this most modern method. But not only that. So to build this project, you need about 200 to 400 companies. So we want to train our industry, because our industry is not competitive, because you have countries which are now becoming member of CERN, but you are not competitive to this level with the other industries. Also, we want to really push for powerful digitalization, because medical data, big data, or data, oncological data, are big data. So we are going to make real network, scientific network, clinical network, but not only that. Our project will be mega green project, because in our region we have a very high capacity for green energy, so we are going to push for the green project, not to tell you that we have 250 sunny days per year. And of course, last but not least, we want to train our innovative capacity. So here is the timeline of our project. So we already have a concept study. We started design phase. And thanks to this financial support, European Commission, we are applying for extra 3 million to finalize it. For the site, the selection of site should be sometime by the end of 2020, at the beginning of 2021. We will try also to launch this project on the ES3 roadmap, which is the deadline in May. If everything goes well, we could start construction of this project in 2023, and if we are lucky, we will be able to treat the first patient in 2028. So, for seized, up to 200 million is required to guarantee competitivity in Europe. Now you can say it's large, but everything is relative. So I remind you, an ELI project, which cost 850 million, only three countries involved, one of them is Hungary. So we are talking about 200 million for 10 countries, and we would really like to be able to use funds, use EU structural funds, cohesion funds, IPA funds. Some contribution, of course, should come from the member states. Now, what Europe needs? Europe needs to further advance in iron therapy. Politically, it's widely accepted that our region needs economical help. Europe, after the Second War, would also not stand up on the legs without research infrastructure, without infrastructure, without economical help. Therefore, multi-ion tumor therapy with a large fraction of beam time dedicated to biomedical research in Southeast Europe will be benefit for the whole Europe. I just want to flash that we had recently a great event where we mark the start of design phase with a lot of, again, participants, and I just want again to stress the CIS project is in line with all this sustainable development goal. Health is an important part in each of these areas. CIS project will be mega green project, and I need only to conclude now that it is perfect example of research infrastructure for ethical and responsible cooperation. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you very much, Minister of Montenegro, Sanja Damjanovic, for presenting this very fascinating project. Thank you very much. So we have a few minutes for the questions, but the first question is not a question, but I want to give a chance for the another organizer. We are not alone to organize, not only Michele and myself. Samin Ahmed Khan was also one of the organizers, and he asked me to present himself and to say a few words.
Hello, good afternoon, Assalamu alaikum. I'm Samin Ahmed Khan from Dofa University, and I'm one of the co-organizers of this program, along with Gert Shaw and others. Yeah, please, Gert Shaw, come along. Yeah. Any questions? We have very little time now. Yes, please.
You give me the floor?
Yes.
Yeah. Thank you so much. Thank you for the inviting me. My name is Anna Projkova. I'm a professor in theoretical and mathematical physics, currently at the University of Sofia. But I'm taking the floor as a person working at the S3. This is the European Strategic Forum for Research Infrastructure, which is actually the body that monitors the huge infrastructures in Europe. We collect proposals and build the roadmap. I have a general question to the panelists, all of them very experienced in large infrastructure, either like participants doing research there or currently monitoring them. The first question is how you can ensure the running cost of the huge operational running cost of a huge infrastructure when you should compete with all the scientific community interested in this field. This is an economical question. But the more important question, which we are obliged to answer every day, is that every research infrastructure needs about 15 to 20 years to build. So the question is, how you are going to keep the interest of the new generation of scientists in the specific area of research you put in this research infrastructure. And at the end, I would like to invite all of you in Sofia, 10th to 11th of December. We are going, we organize together with the European Commission a conference on the future research infrastructures. So welcome.
I will be there in Bulgaria.
One thing about investing in things like advanced light sources, you're not picking one field of science versus another because this device is used by just about everybody. So I think that part of it is taken care of automatically. The main thing that we worry about is just in the various regions, the what we call the feeder infrastructure. You know, you have to have a lab to prepare your protein structures to be taken to the light sources to obtain data. So what we try to do is to invest in those local laboratories to be able to enable that. But as far as the bit infrastructure, though, they service just about all fields of science.
Can answer your question, because in the case of CIS project is fully sustainable, because the HIT Heidelberg is sustainable, because why? Our operational costs will be 10 million euros, and this is treatment for 500 patients. So 20,000 euros is treatment for one patient in these national labs, but for our patient international, the price is 70,000 and more. So we will not only that we will be sustainable, we will spend money. On terms of Montenegro, I can tell you that we pay every year 7.5 million to treat our patients outside. So we will spare money. It will be fully sustainable project based on treatment of patients.
One more question.
Good morning, everybody. I'm Hanan Malkawi from Yarmouk University, Jordan. I'm a biologist. Science, nature. In fact, my question is for Her Excellency the Minister about the CIS project. It's really nice. I mean, cancer, as you know, is number one killer in the world. But my question is maybe scientific. You know, in order I was really optimistic to see that you will be treating the patients, which is clinical trials, in like 5 years from now. But you know, I mean, any treatment, like even a drug, it takes 12 years sometimes in order to be approved, to be ready to be used even in the market. So I'm really surprised. I mean, could you elaborate on that?
So I'm not an oncologist, but I can answer your question. HIT Heidelberg started to operate in 2009. This project was very much criticized. Why you want to spend 200 million for something? Why don't you buy a machine of 3 million like everybody is using? But now they accumulate, they have now enough statistics, and now they show that for many type of tumors, they show the survival probability that you have nice pictures now coming out that survival probability after 5 years of treatment with carbon is going nearly 100% compared to protons of 60% or X-ray on 10 to 20%. Now, more data coming also thanks to 6 machines from Japan. So now you have real proof that this method is really the most powerful method. And I also learned yesterday that even now States is going to build another carbon machine.
Can I add something? As the minister said, 50% of the beam time will not be used for tumor treatment or research, but for independent radiological research. And there's a whole community in Europe which has made a proposal some time ago to have a special machine for this radiological research at CERN. And CERN, for several reasons, had to refuse that. So the whole community, which has nothing to do with oncology, but doing radio research, which is waiting for such a machine.
Can we take a final question there? Then I will ask all the panelists to make a final statement.
Thank you very much, everyone, for the very nice presentations. Professor Schopper mentioned that in order to build a collaboration, the scientists need to trust politicians and vice versa. But recently, what we see is that the politicians are twisting the scientific facts, be it climate change, be it vaccination. So being a scientist in training and then went into the politics, my question is to Minister of Montenegro, what's your thought on that? How politicians should gain trust of the scientists? Is it that more scientists should go to politics? But until we go there, what should be the strategy? Thank you.
I did get the question. I did get the question.
But the more scientists would go to politics, I don't know.
Well, to be honest, I've seen several scientists going to politics. That was not very successful. I can tell you, for instance, some of the science ministers we had in Germany, which were scientists, were not so good. Because if, well, it depends what you call politics. Usually, for the minister, well, it depends on the country, so it's very difficult. But sometimes, for a minister, it's not so important to be a scientist himself. Sometimes it's very good, as in the case of Mrs. Samdamyovich. But sometimes in big countries, it's better for a minister to have political power, to have some organizations behind him to push through things in the government. It's a very complicated question, which is different in each country.
Okay, I think we have to close in a few minutes, but I think we have seen a lot of very nice models and also how basic science infrastructure can turn into some applications which address very important issues. So I think I'm quite positive in seeing how we can build capacity and how the scientific community can work together and seek for cooperation. So I would like to start with Sekasi from the far end and ask all the speakers to make a final statement before we conclude the session.
Okay, I'd just like to quickly just address the second question that the professor asked, and that would be my concluding statement. You know, these are such long-term projects to build, as you say. I mean, it could be 10 to 20 years. And the way to keep the young people, even old people like me, connected until it's built is to send them, like we're doing, to existing infrastructures. So what we need are governments to provide funding so that the young researchers can learn how to use the beam lines, and so that eventually when it's constructed in their home regions, there would be a critical mass.
Okay, well, I think I've said most of what I had to say, so maybe I will just pass it on to you.
I will just make a comment. I really see the light for CIS project after CEN model and SESAME model. I think we will manage. I want to say that scientifically we cannot fail, and I all wish that political support in our region remain until 2028. So, thanks.
Well, let me make a completely general question, independent of what has been discussed now. I think it would be bad if different parts of science, basic science against applied science, or different parts in science itself, would start to fight each other. I learned that in physics, there are some conservation laws. We know there's a conservation of energy. I learned in politics, there are no conservation laws. In particular, there's no conservation of money. If you have good projects, and if scientists stick together, I think it's for the best of society to push that through and not start to fight each other.
Thank you very much. I'm going to start by commenting on what was just mentioned about should scientists be politicians. The day before yesterday, when I had to introduce myself, I introduced myself as a princess by birth, but a science enabler by accident of birth. And I think that's what, at a forum like this, which is the largest science policy forum or gathering of science policy and decision makers in the world, I think that we have to be thinking about the policy rather than the politics, and making sure that we really are instilling the correct policies for our varied regions of the world to be able to fulfill this mission of building the correct infrastructures for the basic sciences. And so I thank you for putting this panel on the agenda. When we are asked frequently in Jordan that, you know, what are the immediate benefits from any of the research that we're doing, and I'm proud to say that on my campus at the Royal Scientific Society, we are now in the first stages of establishing our reticular foundry, which will be looking at metal-organic frameworks and the way in which we can really be addressing molecular chemistry and research into molecular chemistry. We say that we have a process which we know we can leapfrog. And we know that the infrastructure is there. We know that the research culture, there is a hunger for developing and nurturing that research culture. But we need to use all the time we have at the moment to make sure we are building the correct capacities. And whether we're talking about southern, southeastern Europe, or whether we're talking about a fragile Middle East region, I think we've shown that as a collective science nation and a science community, the infrastructure is there now, and the will is there. But there was a process that we established at the RSS when we were developing something called the Drivers for Change program. We called it the STEEP process: social, technological, economical, environmental, and again, the P was for policy, not for politics. I think if we apply the STEEP process to any of our development plans over the next few decades, we will certainly be able to see a much more competitive science community, but at the same time where we'll be able to really lay a code for ethics. We've all mentioned the issue of brain drain. We know that over 70% of the advanced science research programs taking place in the United States alone are actually have a very small percentage it's over 70% are non-Americans taking part on those science research programs. And I think that we are certainly in a situation now where we as developing nations have been able to create a lot of talent. Now the time is for us to be able to capture that talent. And so to make sure that we are producing the conducive environments for people to be as productive as possible. And this all starts at the grassroots. And I will just go back to the days when the ISC were talking about the life science revolution and how we have to really start remembering or giving credence back to the life sciences and the natural sciences. And this really, we saw the trickle-down effect even in schools where science was being taught as a subject. People were, you know, with new programs eradicating specific subjects or times for biology, physics, chemistry, unless those were chosen subjects for people who wanted to specialize in them. And everything was being taught under the umbrella of general science. So I think the question is, where do we actually go back to the basics? And I started my speech by talking about Jordan and how when we were having the conversation about developing our reticular foundry and making sure the right people there were going to be working on the project, we wanted to talk about basic sciences. And it was almost like a taboo word for us to be using that. So they said, oh, can we use the word foundational science? Can we use the, you know, other words? But don't call it basic science. But I think at the end of the day, it is our responsibility, our ethical responsibility in science, to somehow go back to the basics, but to also be able to leapfrog the process. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I want you to applaud all our panelists. This will be the end of the session.